KCSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm a professor at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Thank you for joining me today on the show. Today I'm very excited to have on Professor Peter Swire of Georgia Tech. Peter is one of the five members of the President's panel that was put together in response to the leaks that Edward Snowden put out and is still putting out beginning last summer involving spying at the National Security Agency. Peter, who is the Nancy L. and Lawrence P. Huang Professor in Law and Ethics at Georgia Tech's Ernest Scheller School, the College of Business, who's joining us from his home via Skype in Atlanta, is going to be talking today about his work on that panel. Now, particularly today, and particularly with what's going on, I don't think I need to introduce this topic much to anyone listening to Hearsay Culture, or in fact to most people who have been paying attention to the news over the last 7-8 months. But for those of you who may have missed it, my quick introduction of this topic is that beginning this summer, Edward Snowden, a former contract employee of the National Security Agency, began revealing documents that he had, and we'll talk about a little bit, is whether you want to call it stolen or whistle blew, if you will, regarding massive efforts on the part of the National Security Agency to mine information and data that is traveling through the internet. And it runs the range from emails to other documents to other information, and literally every week, if not every day, more information seems to be coming out that reveals the extent, at least, of the efforts. Now, there's one question, which, and certainly one we're going to be talking about today, which is the headlines on these issues often do not match necessarily what the documents reveal. So, for example, over the weekend, and we're recording this show on February 17th, 2014, another headline came out indicating that the National Security Agency was breaching the attorney-client privilege involving the apparent possibility, at least, of intercepting communications between a law firm and a government involved in trade negotiations with the United States. Digging deeper into that story, and Oren Kerr had a point about this over the weekend in the Washington Post. Maybe when we say that the NSA has violated the attorney-client privilege, it might be more accurate to say, well, it thought about it, or was advised to do it, or advised not to do it, or it had the opportunity. Now, none of that is to undermine or diminish what has come out, because clearly the NSA has been involved in massive efforts to access this information without notice, without necessarily due process, and a wider range of people than the notions that we have regarding access information involving national security and terrorism. Peter's work on this panel has been absolutely critical and essential, not just to national security, but really, I think, to even more fundamental topics about how decisions are made inside government and the world in which we live. The panel that was put together in the fall by the president ultimately offered a 300-plus page document that enlisted a variety of reforms that the panel recommended. Many of those reforms were ultimately not adopted by the president. Some were. We're going to talk about that report. But even more specifically, Peter's work and Peter's insight, given his involvement, is particularly valuable in thinking about how these decisions are made, what the extent of the practices of the NSA were, what the limitations are, and really where we go from here. So I was very excited and thrilled that Peter is taking the time today to have this discussion. He's been actively involved in these issues for months, and so it is, I think, extremely valuable opportunity to talk to someone whose insights really will be unique on this topic. So for those of you that aren't familiar, Peter, as I mentioned, is a professor at Georgia Tech School of Business, College of Business, excuse me, I'll get that right finally. He joined that school in the fall of 2013 and then began this work. He has also an appointment with the College of Computing in the School of Public Policy. Previously, he was at Ohio State University. Many people will know this, but for those who don't, he is a leading privacy and cyber law scholar, as well as a leader, a practitioner in this area. His work has been influential on me in the work that I do with commercial secrecy and trade secrecy and international relations. In fact, Peter's insights, in fact, one of his insights is the subject of part partially of an article I'm working on now involving where we go with copyright law and policy versus secondary users and primary authors. So he has had an enormous influence on me. He's the author of 4 books, a number of scholarly papers. He graduated from Princeton as well as Yale Law School. And as I mentioned, he's joining us via Skype from his home in Atlanta. Peter, thank you much for joining me today on Hearsay Culture.
Glad to be here, Dave.
Peter, let's start off quickly. And I mentioned a bit about your background, but particularly given this topic, how did you wind up being approached to do the work that you did on this panel and that I know you're going to continue to be working on a going forward basis?
Well, I think there's two sides of the background. One is my government experience, and second is my substantive work area. So in terms of government experience, under President Clinton, I was the chief counselor for privacy in the Office of Management and Budget. So I worked in the White House there. And then under President Obama, I was on the transition, and I also worked for Larry Summers in the National Economic Council. So I'd had 2 White House experiences as a senior policy official. And part of what they were doing as they put the panel together was to have people who knew how government worked. And then a second thing has to do with subject matter. So when I was in government the first time in the 90s, encryption was a huge issue, the crypto wars. And in 1999, in September, the Clinton administration shifted its policy. Until 1999, it had been illegal to export strong encryption because the idea was we're turning over munitions to foreign countries. But in order to run the internet, you need very strong encryption because so many people can intercept things. And so I chaired the White House Working Group on Encryption during 1999 that led up to this change in administration policy. So when the crypto war switched, I was part of that process in the White House. And then also in 2000, John Podesta, who was the chief of staff for President Clinton, asked me to chair a process for how to update wiretap laws for the internet. And so I was the chair of this working group that included the 3-letter agencies and included a lot of different participants from the government. And we actually proposed legislation on how to update wiretap laws for the internet. That was introduced in Congress in 2000. In those days, it was interesting. There was a hearing in the House, and the Republicans were really upset because we were so invasive of privacy. That was in the fall of 2000. In the fall of 2001, under the new administration, of course, the same Judiciary Committee passed the Patriot Act that we've been living with since. And then in terms of continued work in the area, FISA's, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, I wrote a very long article on the system of law around FISA in 2004, which I believe is the most cited law review article on FISA, and have also continued to work on encryption policy, wrote that extensively. So if people go to peterswire.net, they would see my background on FISA and on wiretap law and on encryption. So I think what happened in terms of being named is in August, the president asked his advisors to create this review group. And I was actually on my honeymoon 5 days after I'd gotten married. And it was a call from the White House. Would I speak to the president's anti-terrorism advisor? So I took the call called her back. And they asked me to be part of this. So then I was one of the 5 people on the panel.
So I would imagine that on a personal note that if you're on your honeymoon, taking a phone call is probably not best. But if it's the White House, that's an exception.
Well, I think it was a voicemail.
And, oh,
yeah. Now that I remember it, I wasn't in the middle of any honeymoon moments and then interrupted to take the phone call. That was not the case.
All right, good. Glad that, because that could be a rough story. So let's dig in here, Peter. And you know, you mentioned this background, which I'm glad you got into. You know, you go back to, and let me ask this kind of background question before we get into the details of what we think we know and don't know about the NSA. You know, but you're going back about 20 years, roughly, into the Clinton administration, and of course, there's been a lot of discussion. Certainly post 9/11 about the Clinton administration's response or lack thereof to national security issues. And I'm curious, given that broad perspective, and it leads us where we are today, post 9/11, given that those alleged failures or problems or lack of foresight, and there were successes as well in the Clinton administration, how do you think that that's colored where we are now going to talk about the NSA's responses to terrorism? Do you have any thoughts on that front?
I have somewhat different perspective. One of the people On the panel is a guy named Richard Clark, who was President Clinton's cybersecurity and anti-terrorism advisor, and he had the same positions that he held over under George W. Bush. And you know, the in the late 90s, they thought they had spotted Osama bin Laden, and they thought that Osama bin Laden was a big threat, and they missed him by a few hours. So they had the attack that got severely criticized by the Republicans as a distraction and a problem. That was an aggressive effort to go after a terrorist threat by President Clinton. And so, you know, sort of somehow saying that President Clinton didn't care about it when, in fact, he greatly increased the anti-terrorist activity, I think just misses the history. Mm-hmm. You asked a broader question about – I'm not sure quite what to make of your broader question. Mm-hmm. I, you know, somehow the Clinton era set up the problems later. So maybe you could clarify that.
Oh yeah, no. Well, I guess I'm asking it not as a personal view, but based upon you know some of the critiques that have occurred post 9/11. So let me rephrase it this way. There's been a lot of discussion over the last 10 years about ways that we could have avoided the problems that that forced, if you will. And I'm loading the question purposely, to see what your reaction is to it. That created the requirements for the Patriot Act. Now, the flip side, of course, as you pointed out, is that A, the whole story is not these perceived weaknesses and, in fact, there were strengths, and also that the Clinton administration was far from not involved in foreign policy efforts on a variety of topics. But I'm curious about, and maybe you've answered it, what you make of that critique. In other words, a defense of the Patriot Act type powers that came in the days literally after 9/11 has often been, right. Well, we got here or we had to do it because of failures of past yeah. administrations. So yeah, maybe that's a better way to put the question.
I think the failures part is not, I don't think that's what's relevant. I think what's relevant is that there was a different threat. So during the Cold War, the intelligence community was focused on stopping the communists, nation-state actors and their agents. And FISA was originally created, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act was created to go after agents of foreign powers. In the terrorist setting, where you're worried about weapons of mass destruction, it's not a nation-state usually you're most focused on. Instead, it's somebody hidden in the communication system who at first glance looks like everyone else. And so your effort is to detect who the bad guys are, who the significant threats are that could rise to the level of weapons of mass destruction or significant attacks. So I wrote an article called Privacy and Information Sharing in the War Against Terrorism, where I first sort of sympathetically laid out the image of why in an asymmetric warfare, hidden terrorists swimming in a sea of other similar-looking people, you need to have detection activities. And then showed, as you do that, what's the sort of due diligence process for thinking about what makes sense and what doesn't make sense. And, you know, I think this what's happening right now in 2014 is really the first chance to correct or to shift away from the 2001 view of the world. It's 13 years later. We're in a quite different setting. And so we have at least a chance to critically examine what should happen and what shouldn't. And in this respect, I compare it in some ways to the late 1970s. FISA was passed in 1978. And what happened in that period was, there was Watergate and there was the Church Commission that famously for Congress looked at these problems. And so there was a lot of surprises to the American people at that point about what the surveillance agencies were doing, lots of domestic surveillance for agencies that were supposed to be overseas. And what happened that actually led to legislation was, interestingly, very much the same alignment that we have today. So we had a Democratic president, that was Jimmy Carter in the late 1970s, and we had active Republicans, critics of Jimmy Carter. And so what happened was the possibility that Republicans would put limits on executive power because they didn't like the current executive, combined with a president who was open to having rule of law come in. Jimmy Carter was a human rights president. Barack Obama has taught constitutional law. You have the possibility to create a structure that has a good rule of law and good procedures in place, but that also does address national security needs. And I think that was the charge to our group, which was the president asked us when we met with him in August and when we came back to him with the report. He asked us to say, the charge to the group was, how do we protect national security? and protect privacy and civil liberties, and put it in the context of our foreign affairs, and also address the insider threat and maintain public trust. And one way I talk about this is that we have exactly one internet or one communication system, and it's the internet that's going to be the surveillance internet. It's the internet that's going to be the e-commerce internet, and it's also going to be the freedom and dissent and culture and ordinary people internet. And so the task for our group was to figure out, going forward, what's a set of institutions and set of rules that can try to make our overall communication system flourish while we're also addressing the national security threats. So I think that we have an opportunity right now. There's a lot of activity in Congress. I've testified three times so far in 2014 on this, and they're really trying to figure out how do we make changes that can have rule of law and checks and balances and also have good national security.
We're chatting with Peter Swire, a professor at Georgia Tech's College of Business on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. So you know, in the midst of this, we've got these continuing revelations about the NSA. Let's start here. And again, I particularly given how quickly the story's moving, I'm going to again say we're recording on February 17, 2014. It could change in an hour as soon as we're done recording. Give us in a couple minutes here, Peter, give us your broad strokes of what you think we know broadly, very broadly speaking, about what the NSA has been doing and is doing.
Well, so one of the things our group had was, top secret briefings from all the people that we wanted to interview. The agencies were made available to us, and we got to meet with them in detail, senior people and analysts. But in terms of what we can say, I think that the biggest news was the news that came out in the first week, which is what's often called the Section 215 program. This is Section 215 of the Patriot Act. And the program, as now confirmed by the government and in released opinions of the FISA court, the program allows domestic-to-domestic phone calls, the call detail records, who called whom and at what time, to go into a government-run database. The idea is if the government has an anti-terrorism goal and they have a particular lead, they have a particular phone number that they think may be related to a terrorist operation, then that can go into the database and you can see the, let's say, 100 people that phone number's called in the last bunch of days. And then you can do another hop and see who those 100 people have talked to. And then along the way, you might find that there's another phone number that you found was suspicious, or there's another phone number that upon investigation looks like it might be suspicious. And so it's an attempt to connect the dots. And I think the simple reason why there's sort of two dimensions why this created such a fuss. One is, under the Foreign Intelligence Act, we had domestic-to-domestic phone calls. And that was an echo of the 1970s when it turned out the CIA and other agencies were in domestic activities. And the second thing was the scale. So the all phone numbers by a particular telephone provider raised the possibility that there were millions and millions and millions of Americans' phone calls in there. So the scale and the domestic nature of it was a surprise to people thinking that this was about catching foreigners doing spying kinds of things. So I think that's the single biggest issue that people have focused on. There's also the PRISM program was released early, which was the agency's name for what's called Section 702 of the FISA Amendments Act. And that's an authority that allows us, when we target a phone number overseas or an email overseas, to get the content, the full details of what happened. And that content sometimes is in a communication with somebody back home here in the United States. And so there were revelations about how large that was and how companies in some instances were working to respond to lawful orders there. I think since then, there have been many other stories which have really over time revealed a lot of operational details about what the stories claim the NSA does specific kinds of exploits that are used and specific type of encryption things that were done, et cetera. And those have, I think, from the government's point of view, the agency's point of view, revealed operational activities that are going to allow adversaries to sort of plan how to foil U.S. activities. And part of the whistleblower point is, well, gee, in a democracy, we should know what our government's doing. And part of the government point back is, if we have specific technologies that we're using to protect us and you tell exactly how they work, then adversaries can shift to a new communication system and you make us less safe. And so I think my role as somebody who's worked with the tech community and privacy advocates for years and somebody who's been in government for years is to be vividly aware of those contrasting viewpoints and try to figure out how our one communication system can emerge out of that.
And so, Peter, that gets us to, you know, the culprit or the villain or the hero, depending on people's perspectives of the story, which is Snowden. And, you know, there's been a lot of writing about him, but I'm curious, you know, up front, I mean, you know, I recognize, by the way, I really should have said this up front, that you're discussing highly sensitive, classified, and more information, and that you're limited in what you can say. So at any point, as you have already, if it's a question that you can't answer or don't want to answer, I understand that. What is your take on Snowden? I mean, I don't mean who is he in terms of his bio. We know that he was a system admin, government contractor based in Hawaii, and so forth. But in terms of your perspective on who Snowden is in this story, how do you describe him?
Well, I have an op-ed that ran in the Washington Post at the end of January on this. And the thing I emphasized is the huge cultural divide that exists between government and the tech community on this. So in all our interviews and meetings with this huge range of government officials, I didn't find a single one who thought he was a whistleblower. That's just not how they see it. And I asked somebody from one of the Silicon Valley companies when I was having dinner with them this fall, if we asked whistleblower or traitor, what would you say? And he said in his company, a big company we've all heard of, over 90% of the people would call him a whistleblower. So there's a big gap between zero and over 90%. I mean, that's a really big gap. There's a cultural divide, really different perspectives on this. And so one of the goals for policy is to understand, and something our review group tried to do is to understand these different perspectives and sort of soak that up and try to figure out ways that the tech perspective and the things that are most needed from that perspective can win, and the government perspective as well. And so we had recommendations, for instance, that the companies are getting hammered overseas, their cloud providers and others, because they're seen as agents of the NSA. And one of the answers to that is to have more transparency about what their response to government requests are. There's been some significant moves in that direction already in an agreement with the Justice Department, and there's legislation in Congress to push it further, and our report recommended pushing it further. But that's something where we, I think, can do more transparency for the companies to meet commercial goals in a sort of open internet sense for customers of what's happening and do that consistent with national security. But the split in the perspectives is vivid. And a lot of times people are living inside their own cultural communities and haven't even met people with the opposite reaction. And so they can't even imagine that people could have the other view. And for whatever reason, you know, I've lived with a lot of people in my life on both sides of that divide. And think that the goal is to figure out how to combine those perspectives.
And that gets us really to, you know, the politics of this situation. And again, I'm asking you these broad stroke questions, and we'll pick up in more detail after the break, which we're going to take in a few minutes. But the politics here are obviously sensitive because you are, as you mentioned, dealing with you know, somewhat polarized perspectives on what the internet is and what we need for national security. And you've got people that believe that security happens through transparency. You've got people that think security happens precisely when you don't. And of course, we've got a long history, you know, going back to the dawn of government, where secrets are kept precisely because it's believed that that is better for national security or not. The politics of this issue to me is fascinating. I think it's one that, you know, aside from what you see on cable, news programs and what have you, is one that hasn't been plumbed closely. In terms of those schisms, how were they reflected in your experience on the panel in the politics of dealing with these fundamental questions?
Well, I think it's worth mentioning who was on the panel.
Yes, please.
So there were five of us. One was Michael Morell, who was until recently the deputy director of the CIA. So he had more than 30 years of intelligence experience. So we had somebody who really, really knew the intelligence community. Second was, not in any particular order, but I'm just, second person is Richard Clark, who I mentioned had been cybersecurity and anti-terrorism advisor and former State Department official. So he had many years inside the government and the national security establishment. Third person is Cass Sunstein, who law professors know. I think he's the most cited law professor in the United States, now at Harvard. And Cass had had 5 years in the government as the chief regulatory person at Office of Management and Budget. And the other person in the group was Jeffrey Stone, former dean of the University of Chicago, who interestingly had a great hiring history as the dean of the University of Chicago. It included Barack Obama, Supreme Court Justice Elena Kagan, Larry Lessig, Anne Marie Slaughter, who's been a senior State Department person and head of the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton, and others. So his hiring record, president, Supreme Court Justice, et cetera, something. Right. But Jeffrey's been on national boards for the ACLU. So we had ACLU and CIA and anti-terrorism. And I was, I guess, to some extent, a tech and privacy person who's worked in government. And so the five of us really didn't know what we'd agree on or not. And early on, we agreed on a process where if we had dissents, we would just note for Section 23, here's who voted for it in majority. But interestingly, as we worked, we ended up coming to consensus. And our report was unanimous on everything we wrote in the report. And our report was unclassified. There was no classified report because we thought transparency was so important. So I think in our case, deliberation and hard research, many interviews, and then writing this 300-page thing. So I think the politics were not as evident. And what was evident was that the five of us worked really hard to try to come up with a view that reflected the different perspectives. And some of our most important recommendations that maybe the public doesn't see as important are that when you're doing collection for national security purposes, when the NSA does that, we now say that there should be a senior White House process every year where the wiretaps on Angela Merkel and the major collection programs that are being done will go up and include the economic officials and the other officials in the White House. It's not just an intelligence community function because this internet, you know, affects us in so many ways. And so trying to have the multiple goals and multiple perspectives brought into the process was something that we tried to do in our own work, but also something we're trying to institutionally build in and that the president has said he's going to do that going forward.
Now, one more question with regard to the makeup of the panel, and then we'll take a break. You know, as you know, there was some criticism of the makeup of the panel. On a personal level, I found it to be odd. I kind of my sense was what you've described, which is that it was a pretty fair group in terms of representing broad interests. But having said that, you know, if in your experience on the panel, did you receive or did you sense, did it impact your work, any of the pushback? Or did you find that the work you were doing was well received by the variety of parties, obviously, that you had to deal with?
Well, in terms of pushback, I think the thing to emphasize is the independence of the panel. President Obama met with us for an hour in the Situation Room in August. He wanted the big picture answer because he and his advisors needed to find a way through this that would meet the different goals they have. We were set up to be independent. We had our own staff. We got to get briefings from everybody we wanted to get briefed by. We made an oral report partway through the process. But our written answers and our answers in terms of recommendations were cleared only for the limited purpose of making sure we weren't saying classified things. And so these were our recommendations, and it was independent. So, you know, people will have their views afterwards, and the agencies will have their process. I think that the fact that the president asked us to do this was a sign that he wanted to have a somewhat more wide-ranging, thoughtful, big-picture approach, because we do have these incredibly different goals, such as economic growth on the internet, as well as national security, as well as privacy. And he's a con law professor who also has been commander-in-chief, who also has been a candidate who used the internet very effectively in politics. So I think he was pretty uniquely placed to try to handle these different goals. I think his speech in January 17th did that. So I don't think the pushback was the main feature. I think the main feature was that they set us loose. They gave us the ability to write this report, and the world's been looking at it and I think responding positively in many ways to what we had to say.
So we're chatting with Professor Peter Swire of Georgia Tech's College of Business on KZSU FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to KZSU regularly, you know that it's a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways to make a donation to KZSU. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu or go to our website and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, I hope that you continue listening to Hearsay Culture and to KZSU. All right, so Peter, let's talk a little bit about this, you know, this fundamental question regarding access to information. And I want to get to and we are getting to what the impact of this activity is, but I think there hasn't been enough discussion on how we got here. So, you know, how is it, again, from your perspective, how is it that the NSA allowed, or how is it that Snowden was able to have this kind of access? I read an article last week where an NSA official said with regard to security and information security at Snowden's location in Hawaii that, quote, someone had to be last, meaning that the NSA had not updated, apparently, the security features of the computer system in Hawaii, and that, therefore, that somehow was partially to blame for how Snowden got here. But based upon your sense of the NSA's information management, why are we at this point where we have all this information that's being made public?
Well, so a couple observations. One is that systems administrators in many, many systems get root privileges or get elevated privileges. And so if somebody is hired to move data from point A to point B, as Snowden was, or if somebody's hired to run a system, then they can do a lot of things. And so the controls that apply to most of the employees don't apply in quite the same way to the people who administer the system. And we have recommendations in the report to have a better separation of functions between hardware, firmware, software, et cetera, to try to address this problem. Some of those things had been recommended after WikiLeaks and Mr. Manning's activities. But that's been a fundamental problem, that it's not just an insider threat, but it's an insider threat if the system administrator turns out to be a problem. That's one piece of it. I think there are some things that we've seen. Interestingly, at least to date, there's been no release of the actual databases, such as the databases of the calls. There's a lot of security around those for the PII, the personal information. There have been leaks about the existence of programs. So there's a lot of controls that are in place, but turned out this guy was talented at using what he had to get what he got.
And that's interesting with regard to talent, because there's also, you know, been discussion, or at least speculation, that he was able to get passwords from employees, and employees were sharing passwords. And I'm curious about the culture in the NSA around this kind of stuff. I mean, we certainly have an image, or we would imagine, that the intelligence community would be very careful, even internally, with sharing access information that would allow for the kinds of file sharing, if you will, that exists. And we know post September 11th, there was partially a criticism of information sharing within government, that they used the cliche, the left eye didn't know what the right eye was doing, and so information wasn't going across boundaries. You know, what is your perspective on that? I mean, is this a situation where it's simply the classic situation of a couple of employees sharing information with someone that they shouldn't have, or is it more fundamental than that?
I think that the culture is an extremely compliant-oriented culture. It's a military organization. Very significantly, it's led by a military person. There were just in the last couple of weeks reports of people being fired. I think it was three people who were fired or lost their privileges after all the investigations happened. I think it's a buttoned-down, compliant culture, and I'm not sure that this should be the focus of what happened, but. Exactly the details of what he did when, I'm not sure, have been publicly confirmed by the agency very much.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk now about this concept of what the NSA is doing and its effectiveness. So as I mentioned in the introduction, there have been headline after headline revealing, and each headline seems to be in a sense worse than the next. I mentioned this weekend's headline: attorney-client privilege violated by the NSA. And then again, depending on your perspective, you dig deeper, and it doesn't sound quite that bad. And I'm curious about your perspective on the reporting of what's been going on. Now, again, recognizing the limits that you have on discussing it, what's your take on the reporting on this issue? And I'll put aside The Guardian and the papers that have primary access to documents, but really the secondary reporting, which is, frankly, is where a lot of people are getting their information.
Well, let me go to the primary one.
Okay.
I mean, having sure. The reporting about the review group was factually incorrect repeatedly.
Mm-hmm.
And The Guardian was the one who made the most factual errors. So, it's interesting when you've actually been in meetings and then you read the reporting of it. They had factual errors about how many times people met with us, about what we were going to say in the report, about the role that people played in advising us. So I really thought The Guardian, just on the articles about the review group, made a surprisingly large number of errors. And that's slightly worrisome. I've certainly talked to people in government about other topics where they felt that there was a pretty large number of factual errors in the reporting. Now, on the other hand, there clearly was a huge number of documents that revealed a huge number of things. But I think as you dig into each one of the stories, people should have a pretty healthy dose of skepticism about broad claims. And they should try, if they're trying to understand an issue in any detail, to see what exactly has been revealed and what is inferences that's not necessarily supported by the documents.
So are there any, without getting into specifics, are there any specific examples of the kinds of information that were out there that was wildly inaccurate beyond the number of meetings? Is there anything fundamental about our public understanding of going on that you think the record should be corrected about?
Well, just, in the week before the report came out, The Guardian reported, quoting a think tank in Washington, that we were going to require mandated data retention for phone and email records. And our report specifically does not do that. So I think the review group was aware that mandating authentication and mandating data retention for ISPs is something there's a lot of reasons to be skeptical about. And so that report that was in The Guardian was just wrong.
With regard to ISPs, and this is something that getting more into the substance of what was going on, right? The ISPs, and again, and also, entities like Google, that depending on your perspective, are internet access providers of some sorts, or maybe they provide access information. But I'm going to treat it writ large, from Verizon to Google. These companies expressed enormous surprise, not just at the extent of the data collection, but also at abilities that the NSA apparently had to tap into the backbone architecture and get around other kinds of encryption and other procedures. What's your perspective on the response by these private entities to what has come out in terms of their knowledge base and your sense of what they really knew or didn't know?
Yeah, I talk about this some in my op-ed piece in the Washington Post. The major companies, most of them based in the United States, have extensive staffs and lawyers that comply with lawful requests. And at least one of the feelings the companies had was that they were working hard and spending a lot of money to answer the explicit questions when they were required to by court order, and then to have elaborate attacks from other directions by the same agency got a number of them upset. One of the most famous, two famous things on the internet people can look up. One is a blog post by Brad Smith, who's the general counsel of Microsoft, where he called the NSA an advanced persistent threat. Basically, that's been code historically for the Chinese doing attacks on critical infrastructure. And so to think of the U.S. government as an advanced persistent threat that's threatening your system is quite a different sort of approach to think about from the company's point of view. And then a second, there's a blog post by a Google engineer that came out that uses the F word and talks about comparing the NSA to the Lord of the Rings and the Shire after the battle. That's quite entertainingly written. But the level of anger around encryption, around the advanced persistent threats, especially when the story came out about Google and Yahoo's leased lines being penetrated. There was just a simmering anger, and the companies clearly reacted in a number of ways, including by taking out full-page ads in a coalition about their concerns about this.
Now, Peter, and we're chatting with Peter Swire from Georgia Tech's College of Business on KZSO-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. We're starting to get to what I call the unfair portion of the show, where I start asking questions that you may not feel you have adequate time to respond to. But then I do it anyway. So let me turn to this issue that you just raised briefly, which is the impact of this behavior on our foreign relations and the perspective that the world has of the U.S. So as you know, Chris Brigman and Jennifer Granick have written about the position and their perspective, which is that this undermines U.S. credibility and makes it more difficult for businesses to actually do business and have data security or purport to have data security. What is your take on that criticism? I mean, based upon what we know about the NSA's behavior, how much damage is there, and where do you think that damage will manifest itself?
So there's two answers that are both correct and are diametrically opposed. So one answer is that there's been major concerns from allies, I think especially in Europe and especially in Germany, which is very sensitive on these issues after its own history and after what happened to Merkel. And so there are significant foreign policy issues, and the U.S. government's working with that. I went to Brussels and participated in a series of meetings last month on that. So that is the sort of, I think, direction that Jennifer Granick and others are pushing. Another thing is there's just an enormous amount of hypocrisy in some of the government's overseas statements. I think that people have pointed out the French have expressed shock that certain things were going on, and then Le Monde, the major paper in Paris, showing that they're doing the same things within a week. And that goes back to the press coverage. There does seem to have been some ability by the people doing the stories to sort of wait on stories until the French government in this case had locked itself into the statement that it was shocked about certain behavior, and then come out with the revelations that they were apparently doing the same behavior. So somewhere between real harm and on the other hand, this hypocrisy of being shocked that there's spying that goes on in a world when they have spy agencies themselves, somehow between those two is, I think, the truth here.
So let's get to that issue, and this really kind of turns to, and it would be ridiculous for us not to have a conversation to talk about the very recommendations that the panel put out. So let's do that now. Like I said, unfair questions. So the panel ultimately, as I mentioned, issued a 300-plus page report with over 40 recommendations in them. I'll give you the opportunity to describe them, but the president ultimately recommended several of them. There were many that the president didn't adopt, but let's start with the broad strokes. Again, in a couple of minutes, what is your take on or overview of what the president ultimately was recommending here in terms of how to correct and fix the process?
Yeah, I look at it differently. I think that the president's approach was broadly congruent with what the review group said.
Fair enough.
I think all of the changes were much broader than people would have predicted a year ago. The realm of the possible really shifted over time as this story developed and as Congress worked on it. One of the biggest issues was what to do with this Section 215 telephone metadata domestic calls database. Our recommendation was that the government should not hold this in a government database anymore. And the president has said that he agrees with that. They're trying to figure out where to go from there. A second thing we said is when the database is queried, that a judge should look at it and not be done within the NSA. And the president agrees with that. So on the sort of linchpin, sort of, you know, what is the most important issue that the public's paid attention to, his approach is very similar to the review group's approach. And I think that's a headline. I think the president also really took to heart this importance of foreign affairs and has issued a historic document that non-experts probably haven't noticed much. It was a presidential policy directive that said that when we're doing our foreign intelligence to protect our country and our allies' security as well, we've always had rules that we were going to do what's called minimize the data around Americans, around U.S. persons. The idea is this shouldn't be a way to spy on our people. And the Europeans especially have said, we're your allies, you know, we're people too. And what happened in this presidential policy directive is he said, to the extent possible, and they're working on the details, we're now going to minimize when it comes to non-U.S. persons, especially where there's allies, especially where there's not any link to terrorism, whatever. And so we're really extending at a software level, at a built-in level, a whole new set of protections for the ordinary citizens of countries around the world, especially for our allies. Those are huge things. He's adopted the idea that this intelligence collection is not just for the intelligence community to decide, but it should be a White House process that includes the economic agencies and the civil liberties components of the government and the rest. So that's opening up the intelligence community to the multiple perspectives that matter here. We made 46 recommendations. We were told by the president and staff, that they were adopting 70% of them in letter or in spirit. You know, for government report work, 70% being adopted in letter or spirit is that's a pretty high percentage for an independent set of five people. So I really see the congruence much more than I see the differences.
And so that gets to, and again, this has been among the debates, right? The recommendations that weren't adopted. Now, 70% sounds terrific, and I'm curious. Maybe your response is that's fine. But are there any recommendations that you think were given short shrift or weren't adopted that you think were critical or absolutely necessary to reforming the NSA's behavior?
Well, you know, absolutely. I'm not sure what that means, but here's what I'll say. There were recommendations about structural reform to the NSA, to the National Security Agency. One of them is right now the head of the NSA is also the head of the Cyber Command, which is the U.S. military combat command, you know, sort of like the Air Force, but Cyber Command does the attacks for cyberspace. Those are very different functions. The NSA is traditionally, you know, intelligence agency. You don't usually have intelligence people running military operations, and we thought that should be split off. The president's decided not to do that at this round, but it may well be that in the next round, you know, the next time CyberCon comes up, Cyber Command is only a couple of years old, and the argument was that they weren't ready to sort of stand on their own. We also had another structural reform for the NSA. The NSA has these offensive rules, offensive role, which is to break into systems and find the threats to the U.S. The NSA also has a defensive role. They have something called the Information Assurance Division, IAD. Information assurance is, hey, how are we going to protect our own military computers, our own government computers, our own critical infrastructure and our civilian activities? And this defense function, we thought, really should be split off so that the defense people could work as hard as they could on defense and not perhaps get overruled by the offensive people, leaving vulnerabilities in place. This is a theme that Susan Landau and many other has written a book about recently, Security versus Surveillance. And our recommendation was to split offense and defense. The answer back has been from the president and the surrounding agencies is, turns out the best people for breaking in are the best people for patching the holes. They say at a technical level, we'd sacrifice too much by splitting offense and defense. So they did not accept that. So the structural reforms we proposed to the NSA, they haven't done. But a lot of the procedures for how the actual data would be handled or the databases would be handled, they have done those.
So, Pierre, I'm going to ask you two what are going to sound like diametrically opposed questions from different perspectives, and I'm curious to get your reaction to them. So, one reaction in terms of the upshot of all of this of these behaviors and the revelation of them is A, right, privacy is out the window, right? And we've heard people say this. Anyone that has an expectation of privacy on the internet is fooling themselves. You have no privacy. Anyone could be listening at any time and give up, okay? Perspective number two is, again, opposite perspective. Now that the world knows what the NSA is doing, you're less safe, and the internet is merely now going to be used as the, and I hate this word, but I'm going to use it anyway, darknet, that is now going to be overrun by terrorist behavior, and thank you, Edward Snowden, right? So taking those two diametrically opposed positions, and we hear both of them, banned out regularly, where do you come down? If you want to, and I recognize you may not want to offer a personal opinion on this, but, you know, as between the privacy / internet is destroyed as a result of this, or B, security is destroyed, is it a one or the other? Is neither the truth? What would you say to that?
Yeah, I have a different. I think that we try in every generation to come up with checks and balances. James Madison and the checks and balances approach in the U.S. Constitution. FISA had a series of checks and balances in the 1970s, where you have regular judges looking at these court orders for the first time for international wiretaps. And our job now is to figure out checks and balances for this era. Those are transparency requirements. Those are reporting requirements. Accountability. Having policy processes that don't just involve the people who are most focused on the attack. I think that the direction we're moving is pretty plausible. It's not the case that anyone can see everything anytime. That's a ridiculous overstatement. When the NSA is looking for things, their job is to look for particular sorts of threats. They really, really are not sitting there listening to our phone call today or to ordinary people living their ordinary lives. There's a lot of computer sifting of things that are being done to try to find the things that are highest risk. But it's not a sort of, oh, let's just go sort of browsing through all this. The examination we did suggests that there's very strict compliance at the NSA. They had problems 5 or 6 years ago, and they've really staffed up and fixed a lot of those. They found in all of the internal checks and auditing that they've done, I think 11 individuals looked at girlfriends or former wives or stuff like this, the so-called love end cases, and there were job actions taken, and these people were fired. So we do not have individual employees just sort of browsing through the databases, looking at people's stuff. There's a dedication to mission in these agencies. Most people haven't met folks from the NSA, but these are people who are manning 24-hour, watch on things, who feel like they're on the front lines of a dangerous world trying to help us in this way. And they're too busy trying to do their job to keep us safe to be spending time sort of casually going after people that they don't like or whatever. So I think that the privacy is dead thing is substantially overstated. We build up these institutional safeguards, and we're going to build up some more. We have to keep doing that in every generation. We have to reinvent our checks and balances. And I've seen this year as a time to perhaps really build some of those in for the next round.
And that probably gets to the last question I'll ask you here, Peter, which is really, the takeaway. A lot of people listening to the show, as I mentioned in the introduction, are very familiar, at least based upon the reporting of the NSA's behavior. We have a lot of people listening that are involved in technology, policy, communications, and so forth. But as a member of the president's panel, is there a main thing you would want the public to understand with regard to this episode? I mean, what would you want the public to take away from the report and from your understanding of what's happened?
I think two things that sort of emphasize the different sides. So one is, I think, and our report says this, that Americans and people in the rest of the world should realize that the NSA is made of really dedicated, hardworking, professional people who are trying to do the jobs that they're assigned and are not some evil sort of, Mr. Pinky figures trying to wreck things or end freedom. And the second thing is that in every generation, we have to build these checks and balances. And so I have no worries that the NSA is going rogue today. I don't like the idea of huge domestic databases with no outside scrutiny. And so I think we have to figure out institutionally not how to stop horrendous things today, because I think the things today are being buttoned down very tight. But I think we have to figure out how to build in the long run checks and balances so the temptation to use these databases in evil ways can be prevented.
Professor Peter Swire of Georgia Tech's College of Business, thank you so much for joining us today on the show. I said this to you prior to the interview. I'm going to say it now. Thank you for the work you've done here. And they're incredibly challenging issues. They're incredibly important. the report clearly indicates the amount of time and effort that was put in by you and the panels and staff to make these recommendations. So not only thank you for being on the show, but this sounds awfully grandiose and really self-important, but I'm going to say it anyway. Thank you generally for the work that you've done here, and it's appreciated.
Well, you're kind, Dick.
So I want to mention a number of shows coming up in the remaining several weeks on Hearsay Culture's schedule. Coming up next week, Professor Orly Lobel of the University of San Diego School of Law, author of the book Talent Wants to Be Free, Why We Should Learn to Love Leaks, Raids, and Free Riding. Sounds like a topic that really has been the theme partially of this quarter on KZSU's schedule. I'm then going to air the interview with Professor Susan Sell that I recorded last week of the Elliott School of International Affairs at George Washington University on International Relations and Transparency. Following that, Professor Jennifer Urban of Berkeley Law on Intellectual Property Litigation and Berkeley's Current Clinical Projects. And rounding out the quarter, Yvonne Krastev of the Center for Liberal Strategies and author of In Mistrust We Trust, Can Democracy Survive When We Don't Trust Our Leaders? Because of scheduling on my end, Professor Mark Lemley is going to be on at the beginning of next quarter, which is timely anyway, because I want Mark to come on to talk about the current docket of IP cases in front of the Supreme Court. And then other guests coming up really into the spring will be Lucewise Vandelaan, formerly of the European Parliament, on promoting democracy. Dave Quast, who's an adjunct professor at the USC Annenberg School of Communications, who's also the California Director of Energy in Depth, which is a fracking lobbying and educational organization on hydraulic fracturing. Professor Mark Fenster of Eleven College of Law at the University of Florida on governmental transparency. And my colleague here at Elon, Professor Laura Rozelle, who is the co-author of a book called Strategic Narratives, Communication Power, and the New World Order. As always, you have a number of ways that you can listen to Hearsay Culture. The primary way this quarter is by listening on KZSU Wednesdays, 3 o'clock Pacific time, by going to kzsulive.stanford.edu. But you can also get all 200-plus prior shows by going to hearsayculture.com or by streaming through the Center for Internet Society's website at cyberlaw.stanford.edu or the iTunes page for Stanford Center for Internet Society. As always, I welcome your comments, suggestions, and feedback at dave@hearsayculture.com. I should note quickly that I've gotten quite a bit of feedback over the last month regarding engineering. I will tell you candidly that I am also the engineer on the show. It is a challenge. I use Skype, which has been wonderful and generally stable, but occasionally runs into issues. But I do welcome and appreciate the feedback I've been getting with regard to improving sound quality, and I'll continue to do it. And again, any feedback you have, and let me be clear, you can do engineering for dummies as far as I'm concerned when you email me. If you have any specific suggestions, please do it. I've actually implemented several over the last 2 months from listeners who know more about audio engineering than I do. So regardless of that, I also welcome positive feedback and constructive criticism at dave@hearsayculture.com. Thank you for joining me today on the show. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.